This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, March 5th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, voters in Iraq get ready for elections this weekend as violent attacks target polling sites. Israeli troops use rubber bullets and tear gas to counter protesters in three West Bank villages. And job numbers are out. Unemployment holds steady, but a little-known agency in the Department of Labor gets the axe. We'll find out more right after the headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Aftershocks continue in Chile today as the country struggles to recover from an 8.8 magnitude earthquake and several subsequent tsunamis. The government today revised their published death toll from more than 800 to approximately 550. One reason is the initial inclusion of some missing persons in the total. The Chilean Interior Ministry says it has identified 279 of the bodies at this point. The government says death figures will likely continue to change in the coming days. Turkey's foreign minister today said a U.S. House committee vote on Armenian genocide would damage ties between the U.S. and Turkey. Yesterday, the country recalled its ambassador from the United States after approval of a resolution labeling the killing of ethnic Armenians in the aftermath of World War I as genocide. And the slim 23-22 passage by the Foreign Affairs Committee could complicate reconciliation efforts between Armenia and Turkey. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports from Istanbul.
House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Howard Berman prefaced his support for the resolution by calling Turkey a loyal ally in a volatile region. But that has done little to limit the fallout here, as the run-up to the vote on the non-binding resolution has been one of the week's biggest stories. The parliaments in both Turkey and Armenia are under pressure to ratify a protocol that would normalize relations between the two countries and reopen the border. Mesut Alarcan is an editor at CNN's Turkish language channel. He says the stakes are high for both countries.
If protocol accepts in the parliament, borders will open in 2 months. And also we will establish diplomatic relation with Armenia.
Next month will be the 95th anniversary of the killing of up to 1.5 million ethnic Armenians as the Ottoman Empire crumbled. Turkey denies that the killings were orchestrated by the state and rejects the term genocide, fearing it would make the state liable for compensation to the descendants of survivors. In a statement, the Turkish government accused the U.S. of a lack of strategic vision and said it was recalling its ambassador to the capital, Ankara, for consultations. The Obama administration has not supported the resolution. A State Department spokesman has said the administration is concerned what impact it will have on relations with both Turkey and Armenia. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
Michigan Senator Carl Levin has sent a request to Defense Secretary Robert Gates to rethink new contracts to the security company Z Services, formerly known as Blackwater. The letter charges that the government is preparing a new $1 billion contract with the company for work in Afghanistan. Levin wants Gates to consider the deficiencies in the company's previous work before moving ahead with any further contracts. Mexico's Supreme Court has handed down a ruling that greatly restricts the country's publicly funded human rights institutions. Shannon Young has the details.
The sweeping 7-4 ruling prevents Mexico's National Human Rights Commission and its state-level counterparts from challenging laws that violate or may violate human rights provisions in international treaties signed by the country. The court determined that governmental human rights institutions can only seek to annul laws that violate Mexico's constitution. Non-governmental groups can still work on human rights cases based on international law, but the exclusion of publicly funded institutions from this type of work is significant. The founding of government-funded human rights institutions in Mexico was a requirement of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Supporters of NAFTA often cited this watchdog requirement to argue that the trade agreement would improve the human rights situation in Mexico. Shannon Young, FSRN.
AIG has settled a federal discrimination complaint to the tune of $7 million. The Department of Justice charged that two AIG subsidiaries discriminated against African Americans during mortgage loan application processes, charging them higher broker fees than their white counterparts. The discrimination took place between 2003 and 2006. The DOJ says this is the first time it has held a lender responsible for making sure its brokers do not discriminate on the basis of race. The man who opened fire at the entrance to the Pentagon yesterday evening has died. John Patrick Bedell injured two police officers before being shot by a third. Pentagon Police Chief Richard Keevil says the California man was well armed, but the shooting is not being considered as part of a terrorist plot.
At this time, and I emphasize at this time, there doesn't appear to be anyone else acting in concert with Mr. Bedell.
This raises questions once again about the U.S. government's definition of terrorism. Last month, U.S. officials dismissed the terrorism label for an attack against federal employees in Texas. Joe Stack flew his plane into an Austin IRS building, killing himself and one other employee. The Council on American Islamic Relations has criticized the government's decision, saying being Muslim seems to be an unspoken qualification for being labeled a terrorist. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. This Sunday, Iraqis will go to the polls for parliamentary elections throughout the country. At stake are the 325 seats that could determine the next prime minister. But the process has been marred with controversy. In January, some candidates were barred from running, and targeted bombings of polling sites have increased this week. The top UN envoy in Iraq, Ad Melkert, said the country faces a choice.
It is for Iraq a very decisive moment. I think it's actually the most decisive moment since 2003, the invasion that, of course, turned the country upside down. And now is the chance, also against the backdrop of the withdrawal of the American troops in the next few years, that Iraqis really define by themselves their own way forward, their own destiny.
We're joined now by Raed Jarar. He's a senior fellow on the Middle East at Peace Action, a nationwide grassroots peace organization. He's also one of the first Iraqi bloggers, and he grew up in Baghdad. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, on January 14th, the ban came down on candidates in the election. The reason given was their ties to the Ba'athist Party, but the party most affected was the Iraqi Nationalist Movement. Is the Ba'athist charge legitimate, or were there other factors involved?
Unfortunately, that ban has affected the legitimacy of the elections already. Most of the Iraqis think that the ban that affected 511 candidates, mostly from the opposition, was just political persecution, another example of political persecution of the Iraqi opposition leaders. So many people think that that ban has affected the openness and inclusivity of this election. I think it was a turn off to a lot of Iraqis inside and outside Iraq.
What are the issues that those who are allowed to run, the candidates who are running, are campaigning on? What are voters interested in right now?
The candidates have mostly been talking about Iraq's domestic politics. Unfortunately, many of the ruling parties have been using sectarianism and ethnic backgrounds as a platform to running the country in the last few years. So this idea of sectarian and ethnic ruling is highly rejected by the Iraqi public. Some of the coalitions now are running to change that, to bring to the table a new type of politics in Iraq compared to what has been happening in the last 7 years, a politics that will bring Iraqis back to their Iraqi identity rather than their sectarian identity. The other issue that is very important is the issue of the foreign intervention. The current ruling parties were supportive of the U.S. intervention or the Iranian intervention or other countries interfering in Iraq. And this has been criticized heavily by the Iraqi public. Some of the coalitions running now are very critical to any type of foreign intervention, whether it came from the U.S. side, the Iranian side, or other sides. So I think these issues, issues of sovereignty, issues of territorial integrity, and the major issues that would affect the future of Iraq, the future image and the future way that Iraq will look like, are on stake. They are at stake with this election.
There have been incidents of violence targeting polling stations this week. There are also reports that leaflets have been distributed in some Iraqi cities that warn people not to vote, that they would face attacks. Now, who does not want elections to move forward?
Let me talk about the bigger picture. What happened last week is that there was a move by the Pentagon to try to link the U.S. withdrawal to conditions on the ground. And that move was actually criticized heavily in Iraq and in the U.S. because President Obama has been promising to withdraw the troops in accordance to a timetable, not in accordance to conditions on the ground. Now, linking the withdrawal to conditions on the ground is dangerous because of these possibilities of increasing violence in Iraq. The recent attacks and the threats against the elections polls centers are seen as linked to the attempt to link the U.S. withdrawal to conditions on the ground, because there are some parties, Iraqi parties and regional powers, who do not want the U.S. to withdraw from Iraq. Some of them are benefiting from the occupation. Some of them want the U.S. to continue to be stuck in the quagmire and lose its blood and treasure and reputation. Whatever their reasons are, they want the U.S. to stay. So now they are trying to sabotage the elections because they think if the elections were sabotaged, if the political process was sabotaged, this will keep the U.S. longer in Iraq.
Well, the U.S. currently has nearly 100,000 troops still in Iraq. Obama has pledged to remove the forces by August of this year, and Vice President Joe Biden has restated that pledge in recent weeks. Raed Jarar is a senior fellow on the Middle East at Peace Action. He spoke to us about the Iraqi parliamentary elections this weekend. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
In the West Bank today, Israeli troops used tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets to counter several anti-wall protesters. Earlier this week, Israel started to build a new section of the wall in the southern West Bank. Residents say that it threatens homes, land, and is leading to the destruction of valuable olive trees in the area. FSRN's Ghassan Banora has the story.
On Friday, anti-wall protests took place in Bil'in, Na'lin, and Nabi Saleh village and Al-Ma'sara village in the southern West Bank. At all four protests, the Israeli army shot tear gas at the demonstrators, injuring dozens. At Nabi Saleh and Na'lin villages, troops injured another 16 people who were shot with rubber-coated steel bullets during clashes that followed the anti-wall protests. One remains in critical condition. Earlier this week, the Israeli army bulldozers uprooted olive trees in preparation for a new wall section on land in Beit Jala town, southern West Bank. About 50 Israelis and international supporters joined the Palestinian landowners to protest the new Israeli construction. Troops used batons and rifle butts to move people away from the wall construction site on Tuesday and Wednesday.
Don't touch me! Don't touch me!
By Thursday of this week, a lawyer hired by the Beit Jala municipality managed to stop the work until the Israeli court decides what will happen there. Israeli officials announced plans for this section of the wall back in 2006. Landowners and the municipality went to court to challenge the legality of the wall, and were still waiting for a decision when Israel started construction this week. The new section of the wall will surround a nearby settlers-only road and destroy around 75 acres of land owned by residents. The wall will pass right through the front door of 35 families and destroy historic olive trees. Mitri Ghanem from Beit Jala described what it means for the army to cut down his olive trees.
Since 1990, we are suffering. The settlers' road is built on my land. Now they uprooted all of my trees. This is a crime to destroy all of those trees. We call those olive trees Roman trees because they were planted by the Romans. They are thousands of years old. Those olive trees, of course, used to provide me with food and oil. I used to farm my land, too, and eat from it. All that I've made in my life and my savings went to this house and the land next to it.
Beit Jala town, a suburb of Bethlehem city, used to cover 4,200 acres of land. Because of settlements and their roads, the town has been reduced to 1,000 acres. Lamia Al-Arja, council member of Beit Jala municipality, says the new section of the wall is pushing Palestinians from their land.
The wall will cut right through people's homes and lands, destroying trees. Residents will not have the ability to expand their homes anymore. The town of Beit Jala was greatly affected by the settlements and the settlers' roads, and now we are completely surrounded because of the settlement, the roads, and the wall.
In 2004, the International Court of Justice in The Hague announced that the Israeli wall built on the West Bank is illegal. The Israeli court ruled 2 years ago in favor of Bil'in villagers and ordered the military to reroute the wall. Due to the ruling, the Bil'in villagers got back 275 of the 600 acres Israel was going to use to build the wall. Ghassan Barnoura, Afasaran, Bethlehem.
Heavy rains hit Haiti this week as hundreds of thousands remain in makeshift shelters. The organization Partners in Health says that the need for sanitation and clean water for people is extreme. The group runs health posts for 5 spontaneous settlements and reports that the clinics are still seeing around 6,000 patients every week. Attention has also turned toward offering rehabilitation services for amputees and providing prosthetics to patients, but staff and supplies are still short. Executive Director Ophelia Dahl spoke to reporters on a teleconference today. She explained witnessing hundreds of thousands of residents in Port-au-Prince in flimsy shelters during a visit this week. With the recent rains over the past few days, she said, the conditions are deteriorating.
So what little people have is now soaked. They're sleeping in the rain, and the makeshift shelters are already breaking down and dissolving. And the conditions for these homeless and displaced people are absolutely inhumane and getting worse every single day.
Partners in Health also said that they have stopped calling the shelters tent cities because it implies a structure that does not exist. Ted Constan, the group's chief program officer, said the disaster has changed the landscape, making it more precarious.
The other thing we've understood is that with the earthquake, there are a lot of changes to the rock and underlying sort of aquifer in Port-au-Prince. So as the rain comes, the water isn't even going to go in its normal pathways. So there will be flooding and mudslides in areas that that have never experienced it before. You know, probably the worst scenario right now is if you're on a mountainside in a settlement camp, because you're in trouble.
Constan said that what is required is to move beyond tarps to more resilient transitional shelter that can withstand strong winds and rains. The International Organization of Migration launched an effort in the end of February to register those living in makeshift camps. In announcing the effort, the IOM predicted heavy rains to begin mid-March, but it appears this year that the rainy season is coming earlier and making recovery efforts dire. In Nicaragua, 6 sugarcane workers are demanding compensation from their former employer, Nicaraguan Sugar Estates Limited, one of many companies owned by the wealthy Pelas family. More than 8,000 current and former sugarcane workers suffer from chronic illness, and more than 3,000 people have died. They say they were poisoned by the toxic chemicals used on the sugarcane in production. Nan McCurdy has more from Nicaragua.
The former sugar workers formed a tent city a year ago on the grounds of the Catholic Cathedral in the capital city of Managua to bring attention to their plight. They marched daily to the Pelas Group Corporate Center demanding dialogue about compensation. At the age of 14, Guillermo Martinez started working in the Palos-owned San Antonio sugar mill spraying pesticides. He had the job for 40 years.
I sprayed the cane with a pump and without any protection. The owners, the Pelas, were only interested in getting a lot of production out of us. About the time I was 17, we realized that people were dying. All those who worked for San Antonio were affected by all the pesticides they used there, 24D, Roundup, Gramazone, and many others. And people who bathed innocently in the rivers were contaminated because the company also put a lot of weed killer all around, and it washed into the river when it rained. They also drank the water thinking it was clean, but it wasn't.
Many sugar workers develop chronic renal insufficiency, a life-threatening condition in which the kidneys lose their filtering capacity. Carmen Rios is the president of the Nicaraguan Association of Those Affected by Chronic Renal Insufficiency. Rios' husband died of the disease in 2002. He had worked 24 years for the Palos sugar mill.
Every day we die as a result of the pesticides that have totally contaminated our water tables. Our atmosphere is contaminated because they burn 300 or 400 hectares of sugarcane a day, and the smoke hurts us and ruins our lungs.
Like many families of sugarcane workers, Rios' family lived next to the Palos sugarcane fields in Chichigapa, where her husband worked. They drank the well water she claims is contaminated by agrochemicals used on the cane, like Monsanto Company's Roundup herbicide, which contains glycophosphate and polyethyl oxalated tallowamine, known for its toxicity in wildlife. But the company denies any connection to the deaths and illnesses. The spokesperson for the Palos Group, Ariel Granera, says there is no evidence proving the workers' claims. Although the company hasn't admitted responsibility, Granera says the Palos Group has responded to workers' needs.
We give help to ex-workers. We've given almost $2 million to our ex-workers, not because we're to blame, but because the treatments are expensive. And we've made a feasibility study for a renal clinic for the zone.
In the western municipality of Chichigalpa, the Palos company used to directly employ more than 5,000 workers. To reduce their direct responsibility, they now employ around 1,000 workers and subcontract the rest. The International Union of Food Workers denounced the Palos Group internationally to pressure them to negotiate with affected ex-workers. Marcial Cabrera is their Nicaraguan representative.
The Palos Group in Nicaragua is one of the most powerful economic groups in the country. And we've discovered that in their sugarcane plantations, because of the great multi-use of agrotoxics, there are now thousands of ex-workers with a sickness called chronic renal insufficiency. Many of them are dying, and there are now more than 3,400 dead at this moment. We are demanding, trying to sensitize the Palos Group so that they will accept responsibility. They want to leave all responsibility to the state.
In 2006, one of the Palos companies, Nicaraguan Sugar Estates Limited, received a $55 million loan from the International Financial Corporation, part of the World Bank, to increase sugar production and build an ethanol plant. In April 2009, 700 ex-Palos workers and members of the community near the sugar mill filed a complaint with the IFC of the World Bank for injuries to their health and environment caused by the Palos company's sugar production. Miguel Ruiz is the Secretary General of the Sandinista Workers Central, the largest confederation in the country.
In regard to the problem of the workers with chronic renal insufficiency, what we need is a tripartite national agreement with involvement of the government, those businessmen known as the Palos Group, the workers, and those affected, which are more than 8,000, to establish public policies to protect the lives of the active workers, attend to the sick employees, and try to resolve the problems of the population who are also affected by contamination of the groundwater and rivers. We need a big agreement to once and for all resolve this problem caused by the Palos Group.
Last year, a national multi-sector commission made up of legislators, labor leaders, government officials, and the ex-workers presented a bill to Congress that would regulate the use of agrochemicals and working conditions. The National Committee of Sugar Producers immediately attacked the bill with ads in the media saying they do not accept any relationship between the sugar industry and chronic renal insufficiency. Nan McCurdy, FSRN, Managua.
Unemployment numbers released today show little change up or down, meaning the economy isn't recovering as fast as some had hoped or tanking as fast as some had feared. Meanwhile, the Bureau of Labor Statistics is finding its budget under the knife, too, and a little-known office that tracks globalization is slated for closure and attracting new interest. FSRN's Tanya Snyder reports.
The U.S. economy lost 36,000 jobs in February, leaving the unemployment rate steady at 9.7%. Last year at this time, the economy was in a much faster freefall, hemorrhaging about 700,000 jobs a month. But for some, it's not quite the robust recovery they were hoping for. Republican Kevin Brady sits on the Joint Economic Committee.
Our economic recovery is sluggish and subpar.
The unemployment rate for African Americans went down some, though it's still significantly higher than the national average. And good news for African American women, their jobless numbers dropped more than a percentage point, from 13.3 to 12.1%. And though veterans tend to fare slightly better than the general population, recent veterans, those who have served since 2001, are having a much harder time, with 12.5% out of work. Many people aren't included in the jobless numbers. Lauren Applebaum of the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment at UCLA says the unemployment rate becomes much more alarming when you include some of those who aren't counted.
If you include the people who are either working part-time because of economic reasons, they'd rather be working a full-time job, and you include the people that have become so discouraged that they have not looked for a job in the last 4 weeks, although they would take one if they found one tomorrow, if you include all those people, the unemployment rate is 16.8%.
Jobs have become a political football in Washington. Republicans like Brady blame the administration and say the stimulus hasn't worked.
Earlier this week, the White House attempted to sort of spin the bad numbers in advance, knowing that their policies have failed our economy miserably.
Democrats like Bob Casey have the hard job of showing how much better things are than they could have been if it weren't for the stimulus.
The policies that were enacted in the bill are increasing GDP and employment relative to what it otherwise would be.
During Friday's committee hearing, Brady asked BLS Commissioner Keith Hall how the U.S. was faring in comparison with other countries. Hall said he didn't have the numbers in front of him, but said he could get them.
We do make those comparisons in one of our programs where we do international labor comparisons.
What he didn't say is that that office is slated for closure. President Obama's budget proposal eliminates the International Labor Comparisons Office of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or the BLS, saving $2 million. The unit has been around for 50 years. Georgetown University economist Robert Bednarczyk used to work at the BLS. He explains what the international unit does.
They take the data they get, like from China or from France, and they make adjustments to it to fit the U.S. concepts. So when we say, you know, something in the U.S. is the wage in the manufacturing industry is this compared to the wage in manufacturing in France or China, you're comparing apples to apples and not apples to oranges.
Bednarczyk doesn't want the office to close and has even started a petition to help save it. Some free trade opponents say the data from the international unit is critical in seeing how U.S. labor is losing out as jobs are outsourced overseas. But others say the information can be helpful for companies looking abroad for cheaper labor. Both sides agree that the unit provides information not available elsewhere. The drive to save the office has its supporters on Capitol Hill. The House Appropriations Subcommittee on Labor will take up the issue at a hearing next week. Labor Secretary Hilda Solis is expected to testify. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.